From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. One suspect is dead, and a huge manhunt is underway for a second suspect in the Boston Marathon bombings. Tamerlan Tsarnaev died in a wild shootout last night. His brother, Jokar, at large through the day. Authorities going door-to-door searching for the 19-year-old who was a wrestling champ at a local high school. More reports this evening of gunfire and a body. We will look into those. The brothers, ethnic Chechens. They are also longtime U.S. residents. The city of Boston and surrounding suburbs in total lockdown today. This hour on Point, we are live with latest news and fresh analysis of why two young brothers may have done the unthinkable. You can join us on air or online. Have you spent the day in lockdown in or around Boston? Will this be the new response to every terror attack around the country? Should it be? And what do you make of these young suspects? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime digitally online at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now in the studio, Carrie Kohlberg, my WBUR colleague, former Moscow correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She knows Chechnya and Boston and has been watching Russian news sources all day. Hi, Carrie. Thanks for being
here. Hey, Tom.
From Hanover, New Hampshire, OnPoint news analyst and Boston native Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
And with us to begin with the latest, as well as we can keep up this evening, on the manhunt and investigation, WBUR reporter Fred Tice joins us in the studio. He's been out at the temporary police headquarters in Watertown, Massachusetts, where the big shootout took place overnight. Fred Tice, thanks for being here. As we sit down this evening, it's been an unbelievable day in Boston, but just as we come in, news reports of fresh gunfire in Watertown, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, and maybe a body we do not know.
Correct. Reporters there on the scene where we have been briefed throughout the day are reporting several volleys of gunfire, 10 volleys, 10, maybe 20 volleys. And there is one television station in Boston reporting that a body has been found in a yard in the town of Watertown, in Watertown.
This the town where last night there was a huge gunfight. Just run us through the series of events last night. As of 5 p.m. yesterday, these were images taken from video of two young men, their relationship, their identity unknown. And then overnight?
Well, overnight we discovered who they were. And the reason we discovered who they were is that they got involved apparently in a shootout with an MIT police officer, killed him, and then ended up on a chase down Memorial Drive down along the Charles River. And in the process of doing that, carjacked someone, took him to a gas station on Memorial Drive in front of the Charles River, where it is believed they were first identified because there they filled up on gas and their pictures were seen. And then they continued into Watertown, where there was a massive firefight last night. One of the brothers was killed. The other escaped first on vehicle, but then abandoned the vehicle, and then he fled on foot. And the police have been looking for him ever since.
And the lockdown in Boston today, here's where we get into perhaps unprecedented territory. The city and surrounding communities, maybe a million people, something near 100 square miles, in which the governor of Massachusetts asked residents not to come out of their homes, to stay behind locked doors and only open them for uniformed authorities.
Because they thought that this one remaining young man, Johar, was actually in a 20-block area of Watertown. And they felt that if they shut down large areas of the city, they could detect his movements. But they have now gone through searching the area where they thought he was in Watertown. They've not found him there. And they've just realized, Governor Patrick said, he just realized, you know, you cannot just shut down an entire city, an entire state. They were thinking about possibly an entire state simply because they really apparently don't know where he is.
But in fact, that has been done. Reports coming now that he may this evening be pinned down in Watertown. We will stay on top of those. In fact, I think we have a reporter on the scene right now. WBUR reporter Kurt Nickisch joins us from Watertown, Massachusetts, on the perimeter of Boston. Kurt Nickisch, what's the latest? What can you tell us?
Well, just in the last few minutes, and remember that this is
just within the last hour or so that the restriction was lifted for people to come out of their homes, there were shots fired. Police immediately responded from this staging area. SWAT vehicles, armored vehicles, and plenty of cruisers started heading in that direction. I can still hear the sirens. Now, I did not hear the shots from this this position, but a police helicopter is hovering about a half mile to a mile away from this staging area. But we did get reports over Twitter from people in Watertown, in that 20-block area that was closed out, that they heard a volley of shots, not dissimilar to those from last night when there was a shootout between authorities and the suspects.
Kurt, we've had reports of a body found. Do you know anything on that front, or the second suspect, Johar, pinned down in this neighborhood?
Yes, I've heard those same reports, and I can't independently confirm them at this point. This literally happened within minutes, just minutes ago. And so it's still very, very early. And I think some of those reports are observations that may or may not be true yet, because there's nobody there quite at the scene looking at exactly what happened. There may be maybe police there, but to be able to say for certain that there is a body on a boat or floating in the water, I think it's just too early at this point.
A still unfolding story, Kurt Nickisch, just on the outskirts of Boston in Watertown, Massachusetts. We're glad you're there. We'll come back to you. Let us know if and when you learn more. This morning, here was the governor of Massachusetts asking Boston area residents and well beyond to stay inside as the police searched for the second suspect, Johar Tsarnaev.
It is important that folks remain indoors and not open the door, keep the doors locked and not open the door unless there is a uniformed, identified law enforcement officer on the other side of it requesting to come inside.
Jack Beatty, my colleague, you've known Boston for a very long time. Can you remember anything like this? An entire huge American city, this city or any other of its size, locked down for a manhunt?
I think this has to be historically unprecedented. I can't think of a single thing. I mean, the only Boston precedent would be the police strike of 1919. There was a lot of violence, but it was downtown. The National Guard was called out. The whole city wasn't just locked down. That would be the only, and, you know, at the time of the Brinks robbery, there was a large manhunt all over Boston. All the bridges leaving Boston were guarded. But I don't think anything like this has ever happened, certainly in this city, and I can't think anywhere else in this country.
Here's the former head of the FBI's New York office, Jan Fedarczyk, talking with WBUR, the Boston NPR station, today about the scale of this lockdown and whether she knew of any precedent for it.
Not in recent times. This truly is an unprecedented lockdown where you have a major metropolitan city that, for all intents and purposes, has closed down.
Kerry Goldberg, you're with us in the studio. You know Moscow, you know Chechnya, you know Boston, and you've been following the background of these two young men, 26 and 19, brothers who had been in the United States for years at this point, came as asylum seekers from the former Soviet Union, the younger of them securing his citizenship just last September 11th, 2012.
That's right.
What have you learned about their background today, Kerry?
Well, as all this action has been unfolding in Boston, there's been sort of a parallel action in terms of everybody trying to figure out what could possibly have driven these two young men to do this, if they did. And there has been sort of a mixture of information on the web. I've been watching the Russian media quite a bit, and several people have interviewed the boy's father, actually, who's now living in Dagestan, a region of Russia. And I believe we actually have the sound of him from Russian independent television. It's a very poignant piece of sort of paternal incomprehension.
Let's hear some of that. Here it is in Russian.
Terry, you're fluent in Russian. What's he saying?
So he's saying the kids were so promising. They hated terrorists who blow up and kill people. And the saddest part, he says, my son was supposed to be coming for vacation for 3 months, for vacation. He sort of fixates on the fact that his son was coming on vacation. So clearly he had no foreknowledge whatsoever. He didn't even seem to have any idea that his sons may have become radicalized if, in fact, they did. So it seems more and more of a suggestion that these boys were leading a sort of a double life. And we're seeing that also from all the people who knew them in high school, in college. You know, apparently Johar, the younger one, wanted
very
to
popular,
become a
doctor. Well-liked.
Very popular, laid back, you know, kind of chill.
Wrestling champion, his brother, yes. A big boxer.
Yes, a truly talented boxer. His father said that the older brother gave up boxing because everyone told him, what do you need that for? You're going to get injured. You have a young daughter now. You have a wife. You should stop. And so he did. So the mystery has only deepened through the day. What happened with these boys? An aunt said that they became more religious in the last couple of years, but that's kind of all that anybody has.
Fred, is there a profile at this point? I mean, even their identities were unknown as of this time last evening. Does law enforcement feel that they have some understanding and motivation here at this point, or not?
No, I'm not sure that law enforcement feels that way. My conversations today have also reached out to people who are the parents of kids who went to high school with Johar, at least with Johar, but who also know Tamerlan. And it's almost, certainly in the case of Johar, you know, the case of here's a regular American kid who's committing this, and perhaps. We ought to be thinking about it more in the line of some of the things that have happened in this country rather than, you know, a case of foreign
terrorism.
The Chechen
connection. We're going to look more deeply at Fred Tice. Thanks for being with us. We may come back to you later in this hour with fresh news. Thanks so much for being here. Kerry Goldberg, stand by. Jack Beattie, stand by. Listeners, we're looking at a major American city shut down today for a massive manhunt. You can join the conversation. Are you in Boston at the end of a lockdown day? Are you around the country and watching? What's your question? Your thought? 800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is NPR's On Point. We're talking this hour live this evening about a major American city shut down today for a massive manhunt in the Boston Marathon bombing. Two terror suspects identified, one dead, one still, as far as we know, on the loose, though fresh reports of gunfire and perhaps a body this evening. We will follow those reports. Ethnic Chechens, longtime U.S. residents and brothers, and an unprecedented scale and intensity of American law enforcement on the streets of Boston and beyond today. My colleague Jack Beattie joins us. Kerry Goldberg of WBUR is with us in the studio, former Moscow correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, been following the Russian press on this day where there has been a lot. Here's the sound of a helicopter overhead at the scene of police checking a home in Watertown, Massachusetts, during the massive manhunt today for the second bomb suspect. The governor of Massachusetts, as of this evening, saying the lockdown, the stay-in-your-homes request, has been lifted, but throughout the day, public transit shut down, Amtrak shut down out of Boston, headed south, taxis shut down for a considerable time, businesses closed, the streets outside this studio, a ghost town, Starbucks closed, the bike store closed, the pizza shop closed, Chipotle closed, and right on down at the end of this long day, here's the governor saying the lockdown was an appropriate response to the threat.
We were very justified. I believe, based on what we understood about the investigation, in taking what we knew was a big step in asking people to stay indoors while we went house to house here and in other communities close by to which we believed the suspect or law enforcement believed the suspect could have fled.
800-423-8255 is our number. We've got callers right now from Watertown, where much of the action has been today. Paul is on the line. Paul, thanks for calling. What are you hearing or seeing, Paul?
Yeah, hold on. Okay. Hello?
Hello, Paul. You're on the air. What do you know?
Okay. I was driving down Montauban Street, and we were trying to get close to Dexter Avenue, where we heard the scene was, because they lifted the ban. And they could only let us go so far. So when we turned, we took our right and we drove down Mount Auburn Street, you know, and what happened was I saw the SWAT vehicles come up from behind me. I pulled over to the right. And as they passed me, we could hear multiple gunshots. 10 to 15 shots in rapid fire, and we continued to follow the SWAT team down the street. They took a left on Franklin Street, and when they stopped, we had to stop, and they all dispersed, and it looked like they had somebody out in front of a house. And what I had heard was that maybe he was in a boat, and I don't know if they shot him in a boat or he was bleeding in a boat. But
a boat that would have been in someone's yard, Paul. In what time? How long ago? In what time frame was this, Paul? How long ago?
This was no longer than 20 minutes ago. This was 10 minutes after the ban was lifted. That's the only reason I was on the street.
Paul, Bostonians inside and beyond for much of the day today, but Paul, out on the street and immediately in Watertown and hearing gunfire. We are pursuing what we can confirm on that, Paul, but I appreciate your call. Kerry, give us more background. You've been following the sort of digital footprint of these two brothers today. What have you learned about their background, their personality, their online communication?
Well, Johar Tsarnaev, the younger brother, had a page on the sort of Russian equivalent of Facebook. It's called Kontaktia. But it mostly was a pretty, humorous page. It had some ethnic humor on it. But it did also have a couple of videos that were Islamic related, including one sort of expressing compassion for victims in Syria. The older brother, Tamerlan, seems to have been more religious. And there have been some suggestions that Tamerlan may have been a bad influence on the younger one, Johar. He was less of a pleasant person. He had a domestic violence charge brought against him, and a cousin of his said that he just wasn't a very pleasant, smiley person. So there has been some suggestion that perhaps the older influenced the younger.
We've got tape of their uncle, who people may have heard at this point, Ruslan Sarny, an uncle of the suspects, with words of advice for his nephew, Johar, who was on the run through much of this day. We're trying to ascertain exactly what that status is now. But here's his uncle, who was critical, but saying, turn yourself in, ask forgiveness, you've done wrong.
I say, Johar, if you're alive, turn yourself in and ask for forgiveness from the victims, from the injured, and from those who left. Ask forgiveness from these people.
Turn yourself in and ask for forgiveness. Kerry, what are you hearing? There's a fellow immigrant from the ethnic Chechen saying, come on, nephew, come on in.
Right. And now what the uncle also said was that he did not believe that religion could have been a motivating factor for these guys. Now, of course, he had not been in particularly close contact with them, but he said that he believed it was just that they were losers, that they had not adjusted well to life in the United States.
We've got tape of that here again, his uncle outside his Maryland home today.
Being losers, hatred to those who were able to settle themselves. These are the only reasons I can imagine of. Anything else to do with religion, with Islam, it's a fraud, it's a fake.
Well, we'll see. Much unknown at this point. We have a little tape of the mother of both suspects. She spoke by phone to Russia Today, Russia's English language network, saying that her sons were innocent and set up, but also talking about religious politics. Here she is.
Son Tamerlan really got involved in the religion, religious politics 5 years ago. So he started following his own religious aspects, and he never told me that he would be on the side of jihad. My son would never do this.
The mother of the two suspects, Zubyadat Tsarnaeva, speaking to Russian Today. We'll look further at the Chechen background here. We've got lots of callers. James in Atlanta, Georgia. James, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to say that I was in Atlanta during the 96 bombing of the Olympics, and we didn't have a lockdown. Our governor didn't feel it necessary to do a lockdown. Our Constitution says that we have the right to protect ourselves against unlawful searches and seizures. Now, as much as I'm against cowardly attacks, I think all of America should be against procedures by government that mimic a state of martial law. I just don't know. I'm glad that they lifted that, because people being trapped inside their houses, that's not American, and that's not constitutional. I don't see how they have the right to pursue life, liberty, and happiness if they're locked inside their house.
That mimic, you're a careful observer, James, and I think mimic is a good word here. Jack Beatty, that we've got lots of questions about this online. I mean, to be fair and to be clear, this people were not ordered by law to stay inside. They were asked to stay inside. But you hear James saying, look, in Atlanta, we had the Olympic bombings in 96. We were not asked to mimic this kind of thing. Online, Trond writes, I was under the impression that a declaration of martial law required an executive order. Confining a large population for 15-plus hours can only be interpreted as collective house arrest, even if done in the name of safety, backed up by paramilitary law enforcement, hyped up by the media. Jack, my feeling today was that many Bostonians were doing this voluntarily in the hope that it would clear the way for police to get these suspects. But that is a lot of people. It is a long time, and I can scarcely think of a precedent for it. What about this civil liberties aspect here, Jack?
Well, yes. I think Paul was also alluding there to, James rather,
yes,
was alluding to the citizen's right to defend him or herself. I think that was implicit in what he was saying. You can't, it's up to citizens to defend themselves. Well,
or not be confined
if it mimics house arrest. Yeah. I had the same impression you did, Tom, that this was a largely voluntary participation, almost an act of citizenship. We want to help. We live here. We're taking responsibility for our community in the way we can, which is to lock our doors, not to let anyone in who isn't a bona fide policeman, and to stay here and just hold on, however inconvenient. And rather than seeing that as a sort of unconstitutional moment, it seems to me that's a moment of almost citizen participation in self-government.
Everything in the eye of the beholder here. We've got John in Amherst writing us, Jack. He says, a crazy teen with a pistol and some pipe bombs can shut down a city of several million. This is not giving in to terrorists. That looks at it another way. A call here from Washington, D.C. Thad is calling. Thad, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that what the government did was completely appropriate. This was a terrorist attack that was pretty bad to begin with. We didn't know how bad it was going to get.
Yep.
With the firefight last night, it was clear that they had a lot of explosives. They weren't shy about using them. And it was really for everybody's safety that they were asked to stay inside and also to allow the police to do their job. So I think it was completely appropriate. The fact that one of them was found and they narrowed in on the other one, I think proves that, and
looks well advised to you, Thad.
Martial law is ridiculous.
Yeah, I hear that loud and clear. And as Jack says, a lot of people really seeing this as a kind of act of voluntary citizenship. But we're hearing different interpretations this evening, and that is not surprising for something with so little precedent and on so large a scale. Thad, I appreciate your call as well. Let me get one more right here from Richie in Royal Palm, Florida. Richie, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
We're all right. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's just my views on the whole overall situation about these followers, or should I say, quote, so-called followers. They are influenced, they are brainwashed in thinking that things that they do that is unacceptable, very evil, they will be gifted on the other side, and this is unacceptable, you know. And so this is just my views about the whole situation.
Richie, the line is rough, but we got that word brainwashed, and a lot of people are scratching their heads about motivation. How much was internal, how much may have been external, maybe from even outside the country. Kerry Goldberg, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation from Washington Bill Braniff. He's executive director of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, teaches and lectures for the FBI, Joint Special Operations University, and the CIA, former director of practitioner education, instructor at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center, the CTC there. Bill Braniff, thank you very much for being with us this evening. What do you make of the ethnic Chechen background of these two suspects? What should we make of that, Bill?
Well, at this point, I don't think we should make all that much of it. There's not that much information out with respect to how that has impacted the actual individual trajectories of the two individuals in questions. So I think of the Caucasus at this point as a backdrop for a much more personal story that we're still watching unfold right now, and not as some kind of proximate cause for what has transpired. Of course, there's one very large caveat, which is this purported travel to Russia by the older brother. which will be exceptionally important to understand in terms of the operation.
We've got news coming in as we speak that the second suspect may have been surrounded in Watertown, Massachusetts, on the edge of Boston just after the lockdown was lifted. That from local WBZ Boston News and now Boston Globe saying as well, we will continue to follow that and bring you more as we can. Bill, report that the older brother was back with his father in Dagestan last year, that they visited Chechnya. You know, if there's not a Chechen connection, people are struggling to try and understand what would motivate an attack like this. How do you think about it?
So it's really there's very little information out there. There are many competing radicalization theories that we could turn to try to answer that question. There are things like social movement theory, which suggests that segments of society look through the world through certain lenses and describe the world in a certain way. And this creates a worldview and generates supporters for that worldview. And that these large social forces pushing people to act in a certain way. In this case, it might be the worldview around proposed by a group like Al-Qaeda and the idea that there's that the conflicts in the Caucasus are somehow reflective of a larger attack against Islam more generally. There's very little to justify that theory at this point with respect to these two individuals, but mm-hmm. that's a potential backdrop. There are other much more private or individual level radicalization models that deal with things like a personal crisis, a cognitive opening, the creeping in of some kind of ideology, and then groupthink or mobilization, socialization that allows people to really stir each other up into a fervor. It could be that there was a personal crisis that we have yet to really learn of, that, you know, maybe the domestic violence incident for the older brother, quitting boxing, something that we're not yet aware of, some one of the family issues that have been hinted at by the uncles of the two boys, that'll ultimately, you know, shed some light onto why maybe the older brother lost touch with his sort of former self. And the other younger brother followed the older brother down a road they shouldn't have gone down. But there's a lot of theory. We don't have a lot of information yet.
You know, Carrie, in some ways, this seems like the small world potentially made manifest. There's violence in Chechnya. They're aware of that. It may or may not be directly involved here. There's Islamist fundamentalism at work there. It may or may not be directly involved here, but a kind of cultural knock-on, a kind of social reverberation, Bill's suggesting, that these young men could pick up on, be distantly affected by.
It's possible. I mean, I think it's important to note that the tradition of rebellion and of pushing back, particularly against Russia, goes deep, deep back in Chechen culture. And it could well be that they absorbed sort of a substrate.
A model.
Yes, a model. I mean, I remember when I was in Chechnya, a Chechen said to me, "We are mountain people. We never give up." You know, so, and there's also a tradition of the Chechen warrior. Now we have a boxer and we have a wrestler. This is all pure speculation, but nonetheless, yes, there could be that substrate coming from the culture.
I want to go back to Watertown on the edge of Boston, where WBUR Kurt Nickisch is standing by with the latest on reports of gunfire and maybe a suspect surrounded there. Kurt, can you confirm any of this for us?
I can't confirm this because nobody can see this person to be able to say that for sure. Here's what I can tell you. There's a boat in a backyard. This is not near water, so this is some sort of recreational boat that's probably used in the summer, that's basically parked in the yard, and police have that surrounded, believing that the suspect is inside and is still alive inside. That is the site where the shots were fired and gunfire was exchanged. It's interesting that this happened in the context of the restriction being lifted on people going out of their homes hardly an hour before the gunfire was exchanged. There are a couple of conflicting reports, but just one is that a neighbor saw a ladder leaning up against this boat where there had not been a ladder before. And another report says something different, that police noticed something odd and trained in on that boat. But at this point, they have that boat surrounded, and apparently believe that the suspect is alive in that boat.
This is coming in live just as quickly as you could hear it right here. Kurt Nickisch with WBUR in Boston, the NPR news station there. We'll come back to you after a break and get your further reporting. Thank you for being with us. Kerry Goldberg with me in the studio. Jack Beatty, stand by. Bill Braniff in Washington. It's great to have you with us as well. Listeners, you can join us. What do you make of the profile of these two young suspects? Does the Boston lockdown look like overkill, or does it sadly look just right? Can we, should we, shut down whole cities for a crime like this? Is this where we're headed? 800-423-8255. This is NPR's On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is NPR's On Point, special live edition this evening, talking about a major American city shut down today for a massive manhunt in the Boston Marathon bombing. Developments even as we come to air with you this evening, and we'll hear them in just a moment. The Boston Globe reporting right now that police have taken the cover off of a boat in Watertown, Massachusetts, on the edge of Boston. The boat containing the man to believed the second marathon bombing suspect. The latest Boston Globe report, he is not moving. There were reports of gunfire there this evening, shortly after a press conference in which the Massachusetts authorities had called on the second suspect, Johar Tsarnaev, to give himself up. Here was Colonel Timothy Alvin of Massachusetts State Police, asked by reporters his message to the suspect at that point, still at large, just about an hour ago.
My message to the suspect is to give himself up, to stop any further violence towards anyone. In terms of where he is at this point, we cannot continue to lock down an entire city or an entire state. We are confident that we've done what we can do here in this particular neighborhood in terms of our search.
And this evening, NBC now reporting officers can partially see arms or legs in the boat, and the Boston Globe reporting the body of the second suspect perhaps in that boat and not moving. We'll continue to look for confirmation on that front. WBUR reporter Kurt Nickisch, again, in Watertown. Kurt, any more information as we speak?
Essentially the latest. We don't know for sure that that is the suspect inside the boat. We don't know at this point whether or not that person is alive or injured or no longer living. I think it's very interesting to think if this was the hiding place that the suspect had basically been hiding out the day in. It's a boat is covered, it's elevated, and it may have been harder for police who were going through house to house and taking dogs along to go after a scent that may have protected him somewhat from detection. But you also have to wonder why a boat in a yard in this neighborhood wouldn't be checked as well.
Kurt Nickisch, I'm going to let you go here so that you can report further. Come back to us just as soon as you have anything further that may be more confirmation. Again, word that in Watertown, Massachusetts, this evening, as we speak, a body in a boat in the backyard that may be the second suspect. His brother killed earlier today in a wild shootout in Watertown, also there on the edge of Boston. Kurt Nickisch, thank you for that. I want to go right now to Dr. Sharif El-Nahal. He's an internal medicine resident at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, helping all this week with triage of explosion victims after the bombings at the Boston Marathon on Monday. Ruptured eardrums, major limb injuries. Dr. El-Nahal is a Muslim American of Egyptian descent, and he's been watching with particular concern and care as there has been speculation all this week about who may have committed this bombing and why. Dr. El-Nahal, thank you very much for being with us on this evening at the end of this very difficult week. We thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be on, Tom.
And if I may, Doctor, I also want to thank you for all of your help during the course of this week to the many, many grievously injured people at the hospital there. I know you received many, and we thank you for that medical care that you have helped give there. If I may, let me ask you, earlier this week, the Los Angeles Times talked with you and you voiced your concern, your hope that it would not be Islamic Americans ultimately found to be involved in this bombing. It now appears that, in fact, that is the case, though the role of Islamist thinking in this act, they are suspects, but in this act, if indeed they were the ones who did it, still unclear. But how do you feel about this association at this point, ethnic Chechens, Islamic backgrounds? What are your concerns at this point? We ask you, as a fellow American who's been helping wounded Americans all week long here, how do you look at what's unfolding in front of us, Doctor?
Well, firstly, I do want to say that I'm deeply shocked and saddened by all of the events this week, as are many of the Muslim Americans in Boston whom I know, and outside of the city as well. That was our first and most important reaction to what happened. And we continue to grieve for the families and to empathize with everybody who was involved, not only with physical injuries, but certainly the psychiatric morbidities that will come later, and everybody's hardship that will likely last for quite a while going forward. My comments to the LA Times were regarding whether or not Muslims would be implicated in what happened. And what I meant by that was we had made, as a community, as Muslim Americans, incredible progress in the last 11, 12 years in conveying the message of our religion, which is primarily of peace and tolerance and productive integration into societies that we live in. And that is the opinion that is held by the vast majority of Muslims, not only in the United States, but worldwide. There are pictures flowing in from countries all over the world of people living in Afghanistan, in Egypt, in South Asia, who are expressing empathy and sadness for all the victims in Boston. And it's not just people in the U.S. who are productive members of society, doctors in hospitals, people in law enforcement. I have a friend who is a policeman in Watertown who is Muslim, who no doubt is on high alert now, may even be at the scene as we speak. So that being said, acts like this can reverse all of this in a split second. And we've seen that with unfortunate reactions by the media in response to a Saudi national student who was implicated falsely initially. And no doubt there have been unfortunate reactions to people wearing hijab and expressing their faith in the last few days that I've read about that are just very unfortunate. And so my comments were directly related to this idea that despite the fact that we've made so much progress, this may hamper us significantly as a community, even though we are just as part of the American family as anybody else.
And again, I want to thank you. You speak of productive engagement with society, and you have been a Muslim and a living embodiment of that all this week, helping the many who came into the hospital with grievous wounds. We respect that service and we're grateful for that. This is a complicated country we live in. These very Americanized young men with little experience in Chechnya at all, and yet now here this is in front of it, and people try to make sense of it, and it's not easy, Dr. Elnahal.
That's true, and I appreciate what you're saying. I certainly was not the only Muslim doctor in the hospital at the time treating patients, and I was certainly not the only Muslim involved with the relief effort, both at the scene and afterward in various capacities. So, again, do want to emphasize that we are just as shocked and saddened by everything, and the vast majority of us are working to get over this and to provide relief to the victims in due time.
Dr. Sharif Elnahal, first-year internal medicine resident at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, where many victims of the Boston Marathon explosions were brought this week, a Muslim American of Egyptian descent, hard at work this week in treating those patients in the Boston Hospital. Dr. Elnahal, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I want to get a call right here from Buffalo, New York. Richard is calling. Hi, Richard. You're on the air. What are you thinking?
Hello, Tom. I need to echo an observation made earlier regarding civil liberties. We have now an eye in every sky, a camera on every corner, a Glock in every school, and perhaps an AK in every home. I wonder if anyone could define a police state much better.
Yeah, well, Jack, I don't know about Richard. Thank you, Jack. I don't know about police state. Certainly, we are a deeply armed country, and certainly there is lots of observation. There are lots of cameras, many of them brought into play this week. These are just facts of our modern life. I don't know if it adds up to a police state, Jack, but it can certainly be an intimidating state of affairs sometimes.
It certainly can, although here it shows its benign face, doesn't it? The technology spotted these people, and within a matter of a day, they were one of them was killed and the other now at bay. So it seems to have been a net positive for society. You know, liberty doesn't just mean doing as you like without any consideration for what's around you. It's our system is what Justice Holmes called ordered liberty. We have to act. We have to accept the obligations of living together, and one of them is to protect our communities, to protect our children, and if that means we have to cooperate with this redundant technology, and we have to, well, that's what we have to do. Is that a loss of liberty, or is that a gain in what you might call almost civic freedom? That people are, you know, they also serve who only sit and watch. That's what citizens were doing all over Boston. That doesn't strike me as the kind of cowed reaction of people in a police state.
Bill Braniff, let me put one more question to you here this evening. As we look at these two young men, and again, the second may now be, police have surrounded a boat in Watertown, Massachusetts, on the edge of Boston. There are reports of a body in the boat. It may be the second suspect. This may be drawing to a conclusion, approaching with care, because earlier today there were the reports of the first brother, and maybe the second, maybe wearing suicide vests. But, Bill, do you see, are we looking here potentially at evidence of a sort of pipeline of a foreign contagion of terrorism into this country, or something that may be homegrown in a more full respect than that, or some hybrid of the two?
Well, I think that what we're seeing is actually not that different of a story than what we've seen in the past. And it's not a pipeline. I don't think this is akin to the case of Somali Americans from Minneapolis and St. Paul and several other cities leaving the country in mass numbers to go join an active insurgency against an occupation, which happened in the mid-2000s. There was approximate cause for them to move in numbers to go back into Somalia. We don't see that here, I don't think. We don't have the same geopolitical circumstance. What we see apparently, or what it feels like, is somewhat of an American immigrant story, not a Muslim immigrant story, not a and a Chechen immigrant story, but a story of a second generation or a second generation youth, perhaps caught in between two identities. They might have been participating in society. That doesn't necessarily mean they were fulfilled by their role in society. For some reason, at some point, they took on an entirely different trajectory, an entirely different identity, one of violent predators, as opposed to, you know, assimilated youth. And that's not, unfortunately, not that new of a story. That has happened in other circumstances here in the United States.
Though here under circumstances that we still do not fully understand, and we'll see what unfolds over time. We have breaking news. Bill Braniff, we're grateful to you for being with us tonight from the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism in Washington. Bill, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
FBI now telling NPR's Dina Temple-Raston that police have located the second suspect. Dina Temple-Raston saying officers are proceeding with caution. This is in Watertown, Massachusetts, on the edge of Boston. Official fears the suspect may have booby-trapped the scene. Dina reporting the FBI waiting there on the site for a tactical team and bomb technician. The FBI behaving as if the suspect is still alive, though that not clear at this point. Boston Globe tweeting, suspect is in the boat, not moving, according to an official with knowledge of the scene. Kevin in Buffalo, New York. Kevin, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. I really appreciate a chance to talk. It's ironic somebody else was from Buffalo. I want to first say that I honor and respect the initial caller who brought up the civil liberties issue, and I must respectfully suggest that the caller from Buffalo might have been a little misguided.
Kevin,
the idea. Yes, I'm sorry. So,
what's your point, Kevin?
The lockdown fishbowls for me the deep sense of wound that we as a nation have since Newtown. That the same events can seem so different to so many different people in this country. When we went to bed last night, we didn't really know if the events were related to Oklahoma City or Waco. And when we woke up, we saw, you know, images of the ATF on TV. Many, I think, would believe or had a sense of security when they saw that, but some apparently saw it quite differently.
Dramatic events can put us into dramatic paradoxes, and we've got one right here in front of us. Kevin, I appreciate your call. I want to get Kurt Nickisch, WBUR reporter in Boston, in Watertown right now, back on the line. Kurt, what's the latest there from Watertown?
Well, the latest is more gunfire, or at least loud sounds. Just moments ago, people in houses nearby there reported hearing gunfire, or at least loud percussive sounds. And I only say that because police could be using flash grenades, or they could be using the smoke grenades, things like that, to be trying to flush the suspect out or to be trying to do different sorts of tactical things to find out whether or not the suspect is alive, to find out whether or not the suspect has a suicide vest, because I can confirm that earlier today they were warning all law enforcement to just to keep distance from the suspect whenever they did find him, because they were worried that the suspect may still have explosives. So we do have sounds of gunfire, or at least some sort of explosive sound just in the last few moments.
Kurt Nickisch, WBUR reporter, on the scene there in Watertown, Massachusetts, on the edge of Boston, where we may be approaching the end of a massive manhunt. There are reports coming in that it is the second suspect, the second brother, in a boat, in a yard, in Watertown, Massachusetts. Reports of gunfire there, maybe flash grenades more recently. Concerns about moving further in. We will follow all of this as it comes in. Reports coming in from Major Garrett at CBS that a neighbor had seen something unusual in the shed or near the boat, which may have brought authorities back here after this massive lockdown was called off just a couple of hours ago. Jack Beatty, this may be near the end of an incredibly dramatic week in one major American city, Boston.
A shocking, nightmarish week, and it ends with a hope from Muslim Americans and from Arab Americans that, to remember, I'm quoting a statement, do not refrain from scapegoating or turning against our fellow Americans.
Yeah, we will watch out for that. Kerry Goldberg, thank you for taking us to the Russian side of this throughout our reporting today. Jack Beatty, thank you for being with us. Listeners in Boston and around the country, all the news coming right up on the very latest on what looks like it may be the end of this long manhunt. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook with NPR's On Point.